This is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
These are some of the projects undertaken by the ersatz scientists of the Deutsche Zahnenerbe, the SS's ancestral research department. They show how far into a reason and credulous infantilism Germany had slipped. They sought to prove that Jesus Christ was an Aryan. This was an idea first posited by Richard Wagner, the patron composer of anti-Semitism.
Zwei!
An archaeological dig in Tibet was intended to uncover the fossilized remains of a race of giants from whom Aryans were supposedly descended. A scientist who went on to work at NASA under Wernher von Braun complained that he'd lost 2 years of his career working with radar to demonstrate that the Earth is the inner core of another hollow planet.
Fear!
Himmler himself believed in reincarnation, for Aryans only, in numerology, astrology, folk remedies, and homeopathic pest control. At the heart of Nazism, there were hippies in uniform. Even then, they were referred to as armed bohemians.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The latest Bond film, Spectre, is being hyped all over the world, but whatever happened to Fleming's original James Bond? We find out. Yes, as Bond hits the big screen again, we take a deeper look at senior wartime naval intelligence officer 007 author Ian Fleming, where many now believe his James Bond name originated. Top secret mission in the closing days of World War II. A mission to snatch Hitler's treasurer from under the noses of the Russians, and with him billions of dollars in looted gold and other valuables. Plus, as part of our tribute to veteran MP Michael Meacher, who died this week, we hear him talking about oil and how the Project for a New American Century are using it to help America take over the world, using the war on terror as a pretext. And is the British royal family a cult? That's what dying Australian Diana assassination author John Morgan believes, and he should know, he escaped from one. Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. But first this week, we are joined on the line by Teo Aluko, who's performing in a play, I think, tomorrow evening, called Mr. Robison. Hi, Teo, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening.
Can you tell us a bit about you and the play, then?
The play is titled Call Mr. Robeson. It's the life story of Paul Robeson, who many people will know really as the singer of the song All Man River, that All Man River. But apart from being a world-famous actor and singer, he was also a pioneering civil rights activist, and not just activism on behalf of black people in the United States, but poor people in the United States and world over. And he was a pioneer campaigner for independence, for colonies under British and American and French rule, and so on. So although he was mainly known as an entertainer, he was very political, and because of that he got himself into a lot of trouble with the American and other authorities.
What's the thrust of the play, then? What have you brought out from his fascinating life?
Yes, it's a one-man play, so I tell his story starting from when he was, you know, when he was a kid, and tell how he became politically aware when he first came to England in 1928 to do Showboat. Came across Welsh miners who were on strike, and he learnt from them that actually white people could also be exploited by other white people, and that actually introduced him to the concept of socialism, which he embrace for the rest of his life. And so I go through the play just telling the story of his travels and the things he said and the songs he sang, and how almost from the start of his political activism he knew that he was up against a lot of resistance from the authorities, but he just felt he had to keep going. And it culminated in him being hauled before the House on American Activities Committee, accused of being a communist, accused of being anti-American, unpatriotic. And the climax of the play for me is actually his performance at that, where he really wiped the floor with them. And then I go into, you know, some of his famous songs. And Old Man River, actually, the treatment of Old Man River in the play is quite dramatic, because it happened at a spot where there was a riot before and after, and during the performance at this outdoor concert in Peekskill, there was a police helicopter hovering ahead. And so I actually have a soundtrack of a helicopter hovering as I'm singing this Old Man River.
Give us an idea of some of the specific incidents that happened to Paul, because it sounds like a fascinating career of him trying to use, I suppose, what America is supposed, anyway, in the spin and the hype, to be all about freedom of speech, but he found that he was coming up against barriers, didn't he?
Oh, very much so. So, I mean, at one stage during the House on American Activities Committee hearing, he's asked if he was a communist, and he says, I believe it is a legal party like the Republican Party or the Democratic Party. It is a party of people who have sacrificed for my people and for all Americans and workers, that they may live in dignity. And then somebody asks him, why did you not stay in Russia? And he says, because my father was a slave and my people died to build this country, and I'm going to stay here and have a part of it just like you, and no fascist-minded people will drive me from it. Is that clear? This is in 1952 something, and you know, Martin Luther King was just about to emerge, and this man is kind of coming up against, you know, these high people and really telling them where to get off.
Teo, I mean, those were heady days in many ways, particularly with hopes for freedom from the British Empire and independence for many countries across Africa and other parts of the world.
That's right.
What do you think's been the result of that? Because many people today would say, well, actually, many of those countries are still enslaved, but maybe financially rather than by an empire.
Oh, very much so. But I think the thing that somebody like Paul Robeson would say now is, you know, okay, we've got these so-called freedoms. We've even got a black man in the White House. But what I've been trying to tell you for all these decades is that this struggle we're in is not white against black. It's class. It's the people who have the money and the means and the military might and so on against the rest of us. And we've got to keep working together to fight the system.
Do you think that's been successful over the last 30 or 40 years? Because some would say, actually, I mean, we've had a lot of reports on the first hour of this show looking at people queuing up at food banks, and it looks like the prospect of a 3 million more once the introduction of, the retraction of people's tax credits.
Yes, no, it's definitely the case that, you know, the struggle has not been won. And in fact, a lot of people would say, and I agree with them, that we've taken a few steps backwards in the last few years. But, you know, it may be that things have to get really bad before everybody wakes up again and starts to and realizes that they've got to join forces with each other across political, racial, and other divides and fight the system together.
So would you say it's a play for today? I mean, that's something actually we used to have on the BBC years ago, didn't we? Lots and lots of drama on the television, not so much now. But do you think it's something for today?
Very much so. And what I try to do at every performance is I write a program, and my first paragraph is trying to relate what's happening here and now today, and trying to put Paul Paul Robeson in that context to say that the things he was saying then really do apply today, and we should actually go back and listen to what he said. And we've got people like that today if we would care to listen to them, seek them out and listen to them and join forces with them.
I really like your little recitation as part of the play. I wonder if you could do another one for us, just to give us a taste of what to expect.
Certainly. His passport was cancelled, and he's not allowed to go to Canada, so he goes to the border to Canada, and there's 25,000 people waiting to hear him, and he makes a speech. Part of it says, at the same time, I have received an invitation, and no invitation could mean more, from the workers, the miners in Wales, where I first understood the struggle of Negro and white together, to appear in a festival over there in October, and I very much hope to be able to get there to do that. And why do they take my passport away? They said that I had been struggling for the independence of the colonial peoples of Africa, and that is meddling in the foreign affairs of the United States government. Now that's too bad, because I'm going to have to continue to meddle. And I want everybody in the range of my voice to hear, official or otherwise, that there is no force on earth that will make me go backward 1,000th part of one little inch.
Fantastic. Teo, tell us whereabouts and when the play is being performed here in Bristol.
It is Sunday, October 25th, 5 p.m. at the Redgrave Theatre, which is part of Clifton College, and it's on Percival Road. And there are tickets available, so people can just turn up and get a ticket.
Okay, Teo Aluko plays Call Mr. Robeson at Redgrave Theatre on Sunday evening. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
And I'm joined now by journalist Kevin Carhill. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to The Politics Show again.
Hi, then.
I think the most important thing is to get an update on your legal action against the internet giants. I mean, it seems like almost like a David and Goliath struggle, where you're taking on people like Apple, Google, Facebook, YouTube, the rest of them. Do you want to just tell us what you did in the first place and then how it's going?
Well, I think the first piece of news is we've won. Normally, you would hear the following from your favourite local conspiracy theorists, but this is from the highest court in Europe. The highest court in Europe on the 6th of October found the United States was engaged in mass indiscriminate surveillance, and it was doing that through 9 companies, Google, Facebook, and so on, Microsoft and Apple. And that's it. There's no appeal. In a sense, we've won the case.
Now, this is was reported at the time as a safe harbour judgment. What does it mean?
That's exactly that. What the British media didn't report was within the judgment, there are 2 findings of fact, and they're quite extraordinary. The first is that Edward Snowden is a reliable witness in court, and the court has accepted his evidence that the Americans are spying on us. And the second thing is the court identified who was doing the spying.
The other thing is, this is having massive ramifications around the world. It's almost like a sort of house of cards coming down, because I noticed even just a couple of days, the Israelis too have joined the EU in saying no safe harbour. But what is the problem there? I mean, what's happening? Safe harbour effectively is about large amounts of data being moved around the world from one legal jurisdiction to another? No?
No. It's absolutely specific to the movement of our private data, but particularly the private data of children who use the web, to the United States. It's got nothing to do with anywhere else.
I notice that Microsoft are pulling their hair out after your legal action. Their top lawyer is saying, we face now the digital dark ages without the safe harbour solution. Microsoft's president and chief legal officer reckons his 4-point plan might be able to rescue the now dead safe harbour data transfer agreement between the US and Europe. He's saying, without a fundamental long-term change, new laws might simply say personal information must stay within its owner's country.
Yep. And the people at fault. The Americans have tried to blame the Europeans, and that's not true. The way to have saved Safe Harbor was for the Americans to have stopped spying, and they won't. The subsequent to the court's judgment, there have been other notifications, and the European authorities say if you're still transferring European data to the United States, you are committing illegal, you're committing offences.
But what was the problem with it in the first place? I mean, surely it's natural that data is going to be moved around the world. It's just normal.
No. What was wrong all the way along was the Americans were using it as a cover for spying on everybody. And the guy from Microsoft is an idiot. What he's talking about is rubbish. The way to stop the problem is for the Americans to stop spying in the United Kingdom.
Okay, but we're talking about companies like Microsoft, companies like Facebook and Google. Have they done deals with the intelligence services in America there that then to hand over our information to them?
Well, relying on the court's judgment about Snowden, not alone have they done the spying for money, they've been paid by the National Security Agency, the nine key companies, and they've also been indemnified. The Americans haven't got enough money to pay the compensation.
So, it just sounds... Do you know how much the National Security Agency is paying all these technical giants? Because it sounds to me as if it's certainly a large aspect of those companies like Google, Facebook, Twitter, etc., is a data collection agency for the American military.
That's what the European Court of Justice said.
And that includes our children. They're collecting data from our children.
This is the bit that really gets to me. The data collection being done by these nine companies, and most of us, about 80% of us, you know, everybody, ordinary people in the UK, use them. There's no lower age limit. So a child who clocks in and uses Facebook is immediately logged, and a file is created in the National Security Agency on the child, and the child can never access that file or change it. Now, the question, even the media who've covered this, The Guardian, haven't explained why are the National Security Agency collecting all the data? And it's really simple. They're collecting the data so that they can create profiles of each of us, and then of our communities, then of our companies, and then of our governments, and manipulate from that knowledge. The purpose of this massive data collection is to be able to manipulate us.
Now, you may say that, but they will probably say, well, actually, we just want it for targeting, advertising and marketing at people.
No. I mean, I've done the studies. You can get enough whistleblowers. Edward Snowden isn't the only one. There have been three or four others, and they have explained what the data is being used for. And that's now, because that is incorporated in Snowden's evidence, this is now a judgment of the highest court in Europe.
Now, I notice that veteran data protection campaigner, journalist, writer, someone that caused so much trouble at the BBC, he got the Director General, Alistair Milne, sacked. That's Duncan Campbell, has been writing about his life unmasking British eavesdroppers and American eavesdroppers, in fact, in The Intercept, which is probably one of the best sites around the world on this topic. Now, he was saying that one of the reasons that he did the work that he did, he was motivated by a chilling understanding that he came to by talking to inside sources in GCHQ, that the technology involved here and the way they were going around due legal process, getting a warrant to put someone under surveillance, could lead to an overnight police state.
Well, there has been, again, our media hasn't covered it or even noticed it has happened, but GCHQ have gone into retreat. They have backed off. And the head guy there, he's Robert Hannigan, wrote this blistering article in the Financial Times saying that effectively the American spying had to stop. So we were in a police state. It's slightly less so now.
Well, what Duncan Campbell actually said was that practices that were always as much about domestic spying during times of peace as they were about keeping citizens safe from supposed foreign enemies, thus giving the British government the potential power to become, as our source that night had put it, a virtual police state. So that's not even Duncan Campbell as a journalist saying this.
No.
This is people on the inside, in GCHQ, saying we're worried about what's going on here. Of course, there have been whistleblowers. there have been people who have died in mysterious circumstances that might have wished to be whistleblowers.
Indeed.
Particularly Gareth Williams, I'm thinking about, the guy that was found chopped up in a bag.
Oh, yeah, where they couldn't establish. But as I say, the media here are not covering the changes. The party that haven't backed off is the National Security Agency. The European judgment was on the 6th of October. The spying program is still carrying on. They won't let it go.
Why is that? And is there any legal recourse?
No, there's no legal reason. It's the opposite. They have placed the nine companies in the firing line. And vast, compensation claims are on the way. I've just come back from Dublin, where the guy who blew it all, he's an Austrian student, he's 27 years old, and he started this campaign because he asked Facebook to say how much data they had on him after 3 years of his using Facebook. They gave him a disk with 1,200 pages on it. And he started this campaign, and he was the one who got the European judgment. I took a slightly different route, and I didn't succeed. He did. But the judgment is absolute. There's no appeal.
Martin Summers, I wonder if you think that there's any correlation here between the fallout that there's been between Germany and, or should we say the EU, and the United States over Syria, because there was definitely a lot of pressure on the EU to go along with plans for regime change, and that was kicked back, wasn't it, in early September, around about the same time, by Angela Merkel. I wonder whether this is also now part of that big geopolitical split that seems to be happening between the United States and Europe.
Well, one can only hope so, because it's about time that countries in the European Union broke away from US hegemony. I think that there was a famous German journalist whose name I've forgotten, and he's written an autobiography recently saying that he spent most of his working life being paid by the CIA to plant stories in the German quality press, and he said, I wasn't the only one. So in actual fact, most of what goes for mainstream press is in fact directly or indirectly controlled by spooks, and has been for a long time. And of course, they used to collect all this information on their echelon in the old days, but they didn't have the capacity to analyse it. What the computers give them now is the capacity to analyse all the information, so it becomes worth your while collecting information on everybody's behaviour, like the Stasi used to do in East Germany, because the computers can then tell you what to do with it when you've got the information. Well, previously they couldn't.
You mentioned the Stasi in East Germany. What about the Gestapo in Nazi Germany? I read a few years ago a book called IBM and the Holocaust, the Strategic Alliance between Nazi Germany and America's Most Powerful Corporation, which is well worth a read by Edwin Black. It's the Most Powerful Corporation. It's a book by investigative journalist Edwin Black, which details business dealings between IBM and the Nazi regime. Now, effectively, what they were doing here, Kevin, and it does sort of make me quiver a little bit, because it's exactly the same as you were saying. It's profiling. And what they did at the time was the Gestapo had profiles on everybody as a little punch card in a very old-fashioned machine. Now, one transposes that up to the present day, and you've got supercomputers which can process the same sort of information about individuals with no warrant ever being issued for that data to have been collected.
Well, here's the interesting thing. The governments of Europe, and particularly the British government, have known about the American spying for 2.5 years, and they've done absolutely nothing. It was this one Austrian student, and it was by accident. He demanded. Facebook is regulated by a regulator in Ireland, who has a very interesting office in one of the more remote towns in Ireland, and her office is over the fish and chip shop. The Irish regulator threw out his complaint, and he did a judicial review, and that is what did everything.
So how is this going to actually change things? How is it going to change? I mean, obviously, Microsoft are pulling their hair out. They're saying, imagine what they're doing is they're trying to get all the data
back,
moved around the world quickly before anyone notices.
But this is one of the children's data is the issue, because kids who've had their data stolen since this PRISM thing started can't get it back, can't change it, and they're stuck with it. The on the day of the judgment, all the transfers of European data to the United States should have stopped, but didn't.
Now, you've said a few companies, what legal businesses saying, one of the publications that's written about this is 4,000 American companies are affected by it. Also, the chap that brought this complaint was Maximilian Schrems.
That's
as you said, a student living in Ireland. How are we going to notice any changes? Are we going to notice any changes?
It's clear that our government is completely unwilling to tackle the Americans. The only way we can bring the changes is by suing the nine companies. That's what Schrems has. Maximilian has got 95,000 people signed up, and now there's no. If you like, the companies have no defence. They have been found formally by the highest court in Europe to be spy agents.
So Martin, I mentioned the Nazis earlier on, the compilation of all this kind of data and information on people. I mean, I can remember one of Duncan Campbell's programs back in the 1980s where I think it was called We're All Data Now, where he was chatting to people. I think it was in one of Salisbury or somewhere like that. And he set up a little tent in the city square and he was connected by a data link to one of these data services. And he said, well, look, if you tell me who you are, I will and maybe give me your address, I will start to tell you as much as I can find out about you in the public domain. And people were shocked that he knew things like their date of birth, a fantastic amount of information on people. But none of this, Martin, and I'd stress this, none of this has anyone gone through a court for a warrant to get hold of that information.
Yep. Well, indeed, and I think the real problem for Microsoft and the others is that they can be sued and bankrupted. I mean, the damages potentially are enormous. And in other words, you know, the whole US Silicon Valley industry could be destroyed by this.
It could easily be. Because one of the crucial things that the British government has been ignoring, and the data, what's he called, the interception commissioner warned the Prime Minister last year, interception of emails is a criminal offence. And the nine companies have all been committing not just the unlawful theft of data, they've been intercepting emails, which is criminal. And, I mean, what kind of fine do you impose for stealing, for intercepting the emails of 36 million people?
Now, we are not the techie geek show, we're the politics show. How does this affect politics?
Well, I think that, you know, what about Parliament? This spying operation has actually stolen Parliament's data, and the company that did it is Microsoft. Now, some parliamentarians have known about this. Why haven't they told Parliament? Why haven't they told us?
Well, there's also lawyers and journalists, aren't there, as well as MPs. We had a ruling just last week about... we had a discussion about it on last Friday, about the Wilson doctrine.
But that was never... I mean, I wouldn't have... The Wilson thing was never law.
No.
So it was always vulnerable. But now, of course, what they're saying is that MPs have to have the same protection as everybody else. But what we should be having is proper protection, and MPs the same.
So the implications of spying on lawyers, on journalists, and on MPs are pretty... I mean, in the old days, at least I understood, that you had to get some kind of particular... court order in order to spy on any of those people. And in fact, the judge would then look at that in a specific way and say, okay, this is an MP, you're going to have to really show extremely good evidence that this person should be put under surveillance. But are you saying that those people are now all under surveillance with
anybody
checks
who
and balances?
Yep. Anybody who uses the services of those nine companies has had all their emails intercepted and their data stolen. And that's the European Court of Justice.
Martin, what I mean, many people will say, well, and in fact Simon Cook last week from the Lib Dems here on Bristol City Council hinted at it initially, afterwards he told us, oh yes, my email was hacked into, was hinting that, well, if you've got you're not saying anything much important, you shouldn't be worried and you shouldn't have anything to hide.
Well, I think that's just wrong. Why would a spy agency want to gather all this information? It's because they have the desire to influence events by manipulating people. on a low level by, you know, just having a general idea of what the population are thinking, what sort of lines they need to take on things like bombing Syria to convince them and so on, and also by use of blackmail. Basically, if people can see what porn sites, for example, a senior politician has been through, maybe legal porn sites, but that's perfectly legitimate, you can use that against them and say, well, this is the sort of online pornography this person uses, and it makes people blackmailable.
This is now, I'm a former systems designer, and I can tell from what I've factually heard about the PRISM program is that actually is the ultimate objective. Its key targets are actually political. The targets for this program came up in public in America in March last year. So we actually, can we know? But the key target would be Parliament, the British government, the royal palaces. And, I think we have to ask a question. Parliament has sort of known about this for a year or a bit. Why has nobody in Parliament done anything?
Well, that's right, because, it sounds to me like one of the biggest threats to national security I've ever heard of. The Americans may be thinking, well, we can just spy on all these things and make it easy to institute an American chain of command here in the UK.
Well, if you wanted to stage a silent coup to... And you had this access.
Don't give them ideas, Kevin. God, no, carry on.
But my reading of the system is it's designed to get information that is for use in blackmail. The secondary purpose is manipulation generally. But the primary purpose, from what I've seen, is blackmail.
Another story this week, and I know that you've had in the past anyway some connections with this controversial, shall we say, news agency XRO News, is that the detective who said the VIP child sex abuse claims were credible has this week been replaced as the head of Operation Midland. That's Detective Superintendent Kenny McDonald, and that may be or maybe not a good thing. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, one of the problems XRO has had is it's taken, there are PDF file networks, there have been, people have been jailed recently, but it's taken the heat off the PDF file networks at the top end, and that's a great pity.
Well, the announcement was made to the Home Affairs Select Committee this week by Detective Chief Inspector Paul Settle. He said that interviewing or arresting Lord Britton on suspicion of rape would have been a baseless witch hunt. Britton action would have been grossly disproportionate. But we know, don't we, that Leon Britton was stopped at Dover, and the customs officer, the police have got the evidence there, although maybe BBC, when they made their Panorama documentary, didn't read the Daily Telegraph article about it. They said before Settle was appointed to the paedophile unit, he'd been a staff officer to John Yates, who oversaw one of the operations revisiting the murder of private investigator Daniel Morgan.
Yeah, and again, cover-ups the whole way. Those who most want to cover up for the paedophile rings are now in the driving seat because of mistakes like McDonald's. He shouldn't have said that till he'd done the investigation. That was a very serious error of judgment.
I've done a little bit of digging around this guy, Detective Chief Inspector Paul Settle, only to discover that someone that's had dealings with him over the years over a police corruption case and actually found that he was supposed to be doing all the press work in order to make sure there was a big press conference about exposing police corruption, and it turned out he hadn't actually done any. And so when the press conference came, the only people that turned up at that press conference had been by the victim of the police corruption, and Paul Settle hadn't got anybody into the room for the press conference at all.
But this is when, the cover-up... in one case, you could say, why do we take the police seriously after Hillsborough? They're wedded to cover-ups. And they're wedded to blaming other people for their mistakes. But there's...
One of the things that's been frustrating me the last few weeks has been this sort of almost like a campaign to say that there is no such thing as this VIP default network. If you go back to the Daily Mirror 13th of December last year, there's a massive article with 30 former police officers venting their anger online, heaping pressure on the probe by Scotland Yard and the government into widespread claims of historic sexual abuse. One officer said his investigation into a paedophile ring was shut down. He claimed as the operation expanded up the greasy pole of high society, the job was canned.
Yep. This is the big...
And that's just one of 30.
Yeah, and this is... some people in the establishment are taking advantage of the mistakes made over Britain. But look at the attacks on Tom Watson. Tom was just doing his job as an MP. You know, constituents would come to him with a complaint, and it's his job to pass them on. But now he's being hammered for being, you know... But the truth is, Tom was getting too close. Tom Watson could see where the cover-ups were.
Well, talking about cover-ups, we've also had news this week. A former investigative journalist friend of mine contacted me with this interview of the 7-7 so-called mastermind, Haroon Aswat. And he was shipped over to the United States. But as part of that trial, more information has come out that he was involved with two, at least, of the alleged bombers of 7-7 over in Pakistan. And my question is, you can have a listen to this now. This is a report from Sky News. But my question is, why hasn't this Haroon Aswat's meeting over in Pakistan with these two alleged bombers from 7-7, why wasn't that revealed to the families of the victims of 7-7 and also at the inquest that took place here in Britain? It's only been revealed in the United States, so you can have a listen to that Sky report now.
Abu Hamza's right-hand man, the British terrorist Haroon Aswat, has tonight been sentenced to 20 years in prison in a US court. Let's go live to Washington, D.C. Jason Farrell is there. Jason Farrell, what did Aswat do for Abu Hamza?
Well, he'd known Abu Hamza since 1995 and had been radicalised by him, it seems. And he'd gone out to Oregon to buy some land, try and set up a terrorist training camp to train American Muslims to go and fight in the war in Afghanistan. He later went to Pakistan and his name turned up on a ledger that was found by US authorities that linked him to Al-Qaeda. This is a ledger that was found in an Al-Qaeda safe house. He was also known to have met two of the London bombers, Mohammed Sadiq Khan and Shehzad Tanweer, whilst he was in Pakistan. He was eventually picked up by authorities in Africa and deported back to the UK in 2005. And there was quite a long extradition case because he was suffering from paranoid schizophrenia and was being treated for that. And the European Court of Human Rights held up his extradition to the US, but the Americans promised to give him good conditions within prison. And in fact, in sentencing him, Catherine Forrest, the district judge, said that he would continue to have psychiatric help whilst in prison. And it's thought that he could also apply to serve his sentence back in the UK.
So, Martin, I wonder why we didn't hear about that, Haroon Aswat had actually met up with Khan and Tanweer over in Pakistan before he was sent off to America.
Well, I mean, when Paddock was still in the investigating officer on this, he raised this question. And, of course, John Loftus, who was the former special FBI prosecutor in the US, said that he was basically an MI6 double agent. And if you look at his history, he's arrested in various countries and then released after pressure from the British authorities. And if it turns out that the so-called mastermind of 7-7 is an MI6 double agent, I think the audience can draw their own conclusion about what that suggests about everything that's been going on.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
So as the latest James Bond film Spectre hits the big screens, we take a deeper look now at serious wartime naval intelligence senior wartime naval intelligence officer 007 author Ian Fleming, where many now believe his James Bond name originated a top secret mission in the closing days of World War II to snatch Hitler's treasurer Martin Bormann from under the noses of the Russians, and with him billions of dollars in looted gold and other valuables. But what happened to that money anyway? A bit of revelation to go along with the Bond film this week from Lawrence DeMello over in Argentina. And I started by asking her about her change from working here in Britain over to Argentina, why she went there.
I made a lifestyle change and I came here in 2002. Previously to that, I was a fairly mainstream producer and journalist and working out of Pinewood Studios. So when I came here, I always had a great interest, when I say a healthy interest, in Nazis and where they went and the rat lines. So it was almost a natural progression that television networks here were not really what I was used to working with. I was used to dealing with high-end networks. So I started to sort of read a lot of material and slowly, realised that there really was a very strong post-World War II Nazi community here, and that high-ranking Nazis, which we know, already came here, but Bormann had certainly been here in South America. So I followed that trail. Initially, I was looking to do a programme called Children of Odessa, and I was actually in contact, and I actually still in contact with some grandchildren of name infamous Nazis that came here. But slowly, slowly, I realized that Bormann was just such a big fish, and he was so important to the whole situation that's gone on today in the European Union, etc. I mean, the one to follow was Bormann. I mean, we've all done the Children of Nazis and what's happened, but it just progressed on to following Martin Bormann. When I bump into people and I have friends saying, oh, Lawrence is doing that while she's here, maybe I'll bump into some people from the UK that come over to Buenos Aires for whatever reason. And they'll say, oh, Lawrence is on the trail. She's investigating. They say, oh, who are you investigating? I say, oh, Martin Bormann. You would be amazed, Tony, how many people do not even know who Martin Bormann was. And I find that frightening in a way, because he was such an important figure throughout World War II, particularly when we're talking about the appropriated funds from Jews and whatever, whoever that Germany stole from during World War II, gold, whether it be art, whatever. Martin Bormann was the one that managed all of that. I mean, he was a very ambitious, not particularly educated, very clever, and he slowly, slowly worked himself up so he became indispensable to Hitler. Hitler trusted him completely. He was a very clever man as far as keeping accounts and managing banks, etc. So he was the man that had the reins, had the keys to those deposit accounts in 1945.
There's quite a dispute, isn't there, in Europe and particularly in Germany about whether he actually survived the war. So what evidence have you found in South America that he did?
At the end of 1945, when we were in such a terrible situation, the USA, Britain, the Western intelligence services utilized high-ranking former Nazi officials for their own means, etc. Why would they not go after the money man? It does not make sense. I mean, there's no way that they would not have found Martin Bormann. Now, Martin Bormann, when you say what evidence do we have? What evidence do we have that he's dead? That's how we really need to approach this. Because the onus should be on them to tell us that he certainly died. No, there was a body, but the forensics of the body show that the body actually died much, much later than 1945. And whose testimony are we relying on? Two Russian soldiers? So when you say what evidence we have, we should be asking, what evidence is there that Martin Bormann certainly died in 1945?
Have you discovered any real evidence that he was in South America?
Well, I've interviewed various people, which I would say are very reliable witnesses. One of them was Commissioner George Silvio Colotto, and he was the former chief of the Federal Police in Buenos Aires, pretty tough position. And he was the ADC to seven Argentine presidents, all the way from Farrell up to Onganía. And one of the presidents he was extremely close to was Domingo Perón and Evita, his wife, Eva. And it was during that time that he told me that he actually met Martin Bormann in Buenos Aires at the end of 1952 and was connected to him until sort of mid-1953, looking after his security here while he was in Buenos Aires, and also being the middleman to take bills to be paid personally by Juan Perón for Martin Bormann's stay here in Buenos Aires. I absolutely believe this gentleman. He's written many, many books. He's been imprisoned. He was imprisoned. He was accused of being involved with a dictatorship, which, of course, there's always a witch hunt here. But a very, very well-read, qualified, experienced man, independently wealthy. Tony, no reason for him. He wasn't earning any money out of releasing this information. He asked me to help him with his diaries, which I did. And, of course, we built up a relationship, just as I did with John Ainsworth Davis. And the interesting thing is all the stories sort of fit together. The stories I got from John Ainsworth Davis fit exactly with what George Colotta was saying. There's another man, Captain Monasterio, who I'm in touch with. He's still alive today. He also knows about Martin Bormann, one of his friends. So this is not just hearsay. I mean, of course, there have been detailed security efforts to wipe away any evidence of that, but we have to trust people's testimony. I mean, people have been hung for testimony. So why is it that when people give a statement to say that Martin Bormann was certainly here, he lived at that address, I mean, come on, Mengele was here, Karl Wernert was here, Adolf Eichmann was here, Klaus Barbie was here. I mean, how many need to be here, but the money man's not here?
Why do you think South America was such a magnet after World War II? I mean, you've talked about the children of Odessa. I mean, it does sound as if this was a kind of network to help Nazis escape, and there was quite a bit of planning that went into it. But why South America?
Well, actually, even before World War II, there were lots of Germans coming over to South America from the Southern Hemisphere. We're away from everything else. We're away from the Western intelligence services, etc. It's a completely independent, it's cowboy land, basically. And money rules, corruption is rife. So anybody that has a little bit of power and a bit of money can do basically what they want. It's an enormous country. You've got everything here. So Richter, the scientist, came here. He was funded by Perón to come here and do his atomic experiments, etc., right down in the south of Argentina. I mean, that's factual. You can go there today and see the ruins. A colleague of mine has been there and taken some amazing photographs and seen some amazing documents. That was in the 40s. He was here in the 50s. Richter was here. I have a colleague here, actually, who's done an enormous amount of research on that, which would probably be useful to you. Have an interview with him one day. So they were coming over here even before the end of World War II. They knew, but when things were getting tricky there, they already put into place a plan that this would be the perfect place to escape to. You wouldn't be found here. You could experiment here. You could be involved in weapons. And of course, the Argentine government would pick up anybody that wanted to be involved with them because, you know, they were sort of outcasts in a way. I mean, they wanted to feel like they were part of the Western world, but they never really have been, just as they're not today. They will pick up any dredges of anyone that wants to come in with a bit of brain power and a bit of money. Of course, they're going to go for it because they want to try and compete with the big boys. I think they're probably just whores in that. They're probably somebody that would give them something they felt that was going to further their feet on the international stage. I don't really believe it was about communists or anything like that. I mean, come on, Che Guevara was Argentine. Il Che. I mean, the people here in Argentina, they love Che. You still go around today. In fact, my son's got one. He was given a T-shirt with a big red T-shirt with Che Guevara on. So you have even the upper classes here who were always pro-Nazi that still think Che is a great hero. Well, who was Che? He was the biggest communist. That's what the CIA used Klaus Barbie to go in and try and get hold of to try and catch Che Guevara. So, you know, there are lots of contradictions. Certainly, I will put my hand in the fire. Martin Bormann was here, connected to what's going on in the European Union today. That's another thing, Tony. People say, but this happened such a long time ago. This is not important. It's very, very important, this. It's very important. I mean, when you think what's going on, I mean, the European Union, we're controlled by Germany today. We're controlled by Germany. Let's look at it this way. Make it simple. Martin Bormann was taken by British intelligence services out of Germany so they could get hold of the funds that were controlled by Nazi Germany. Mainly, most of those funds were in Switzerland, of course, and Switzerland was neutral. They took hold of those funds. I'm pretty sure what they used those funds for. They weren't going to hand the money over immediately. Martin wasn't going to do that. He was going to say, okay, I will drip feed some projects of yours, and when that project's done and I have stood by the agreement that we have, you have to release me. And that is exactly what happened. I believe Martin Bormann was released at the end of 1952. Just work it out what was going on in 1952. He was released. He went to Brazil. He met up with the Mengele. We know Mengele was there at that time. And then Mengele then came to Argentina. He was given a license to practice as a doctor of medicine here, formally, with his name. And Martin Bormann also came to Argentina.
I mean, you've painted a pretty strong picture there of this Martin Bormann, who nobody seems to have heard of, even though he was one of the most powerful people at the end of the Second World War, certainly the richest. Obviously, he's doing deals for his safe passage. Some of that Nazi wealth is exchanged as part of those deals. But, he's got literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of pounds left over. Where did it go, do you think, at the end of the Second World War? This is one of those questions that's always left hanging in the air.
I'll tell you where I believe it went. It went into the British atomic program. I'm absolutely convinced that is where the money went. And we need to ask the question, when the atomic program was revealed in British Parliament early in 1952, now let's just go back and analyze that. 1945, Britain was on her knees economically and structurally. I mean, she was a mess. We were in debt because, let's not forget this, everybody thinks the Americans helped us. It wasn't, they were like, they came in like mercenaries. Yeah, they came in to cover their ass after Pearl Harbor. We were on our knees within 7 years of being absolutely minus 12. How did Britain manage to finance and develop an atomic weapon? And nobody asks that question. And I'll tell you how that was financed. That was where the money came from. Churchill went in, he got Bormann, put it in a simple form. Okay, here's the deal. Like they did deals with Barbie and all the others. This is the deal with you, Bormann. We want the Dutch. So you are going to finance the atomic program for us because we're not happy with the Americans. Aha. So Bormann has drip-fed that. That's why he was kept in Europe until, I would say, at least 1951. And when he finished his commitment with financing the atomic bomb, what happens? And also, let's notice something. Churchill took a step back. Churchill, he should have been the hero, shouldn't he, of World War II? Winston Churchill, my God, everybody loved him. He came out and made the most crazy statement, something about we need to do something like the Gestapo. I can't remember what the comment was. But basically, he sabotaged his chance of being elected. Now, I believe that was a deliberate ploy because he had to take a back seat because he was involved in the extraction of Martin Bormann. And it's a question of sort of getting rid of the responsibility. He took a back seat. He was involved in the atomic program. And then what happens? In 1951, he comes back onto the front benches. And when he reveals in 1952... early in the year, it's April or May, he tells the Parliament, we've actually developed a bomb. Everybody was aghast. They didn't even know that we had an atomic program. Question, I'm going to have to find the quote for you, and you're going to have to read it one day, Tony. There's a quote, that actually was used in 2014 in Parliament, and somebody actually reads out the comments that were made that day when Churchill revealed the atomic program in Parliament in 1952. And the questions were asked by certain ministers like, wow, we've got the bomb. And they said, now let's, over £100 million, 1951 1952, it's a lot of money. I don't know what that is worth today. I'm not very, very good on economics, but anyway, so questions were asked in the House. It's actually on the record. Well, where did the money come from? And Churchill said words to the effect of, well, yes, I know accounts weren't done, but basically it's done now. Don't ask questions. We have the weapon. Let's move forward. In the future, we'll keep track. Where did the £100 million come from? And in parallel to that, I want to say, why, with all the forensic, the control that there is, internet, whatever, they know everything that we're doing. They know what color underwear we've got on. Since 1945 to 2015, nobody has found those funds that were taken by Nazi Germany. Nobody has found which bank they're in, where they are, where the stocks, where the shares, where the bonds, where the gold. Occasionally, a painting will come out. But why has it never been found? Because it was found. It wasn't lost. It was taken by the British government. The Americans then were informed afterwards, because the Americans were pissed off, basically, excuse my French, that the British were taking control. But we needed the bomb. We didn't want to be behind the Americans. We needed the bomb. And that's where I believe that money was. The other was invested into companies, 750 companies, and that's which led to Europe today. But I think that's where we need to be looking. And I'm in my investigation at this point with other people looking at this, and I really do believe that's where the money went. And the timing. I didn't even think about the atomic. It came to me through certain sources here, paperwork and other things I've heard about Martin Bormann, that the timing is exactly that. Martin Bormann appears in South America just before Churchill announces the atomic bomb in Parliament. Now, I know people can say, well, this is all just conjecture. It's all just coincidental. Yeah, it's coincidental, but where's the money? Where did we get the bomb from?
Lawrence DeMello there speaking to me this week from Buenos Aires. And I wonder what you make of the conjecture there, Kevin, because it's certainly, you know, if it's going to cost you £100 million and you haven't got that £100 million, where did the money come to develop the British atomic weapons?
I think it's the perfect question. The thing she didn't mention, and nobody's ever understood, is that when he became Prime Minister in 1951, Churchill, for the first time in British history, made himself the Defence Minister as well. He held both portfolios. And I mean, 100 million then is the equivalent of about 5 billion now. So it's, I mean, it's big.
Yeah, so interesting. Martin, I mean, the connection with the Bond films, we know, but I think we should just make it a bit clearer, is that the name James Bond came from this Christopher Crichton book. His real name's John Ainsworth Davis, but he had to have a pen name because it was a factual book and he was afraid of being arrested under the Official Secrets Act, which talks about this raid to snatch Bormann in 1945, literally just days before the end of the Second World War. And Ian Fleming was involved too.
Well, Ian Fleming was the line manager for John Ainsworth Davis, who actually was infiltrated into Germany to extract Bormann, according to the book Operation OpJB, which people need to look up and research.
One of the books we didn't mention there is, well, Lawrence mentioned the 750 corporations that Bormann set up with whatever money he had remaining after he'd come over from the atomic bomb project here. And those 750 companies were populated with Nazis who'd then taken off their swastikas, not just Nazis, but people who'd supported the Nazis, fascists from all parts of the world, actually, and put on suits and strolled into the boardroom.
Well, the book was Paul Manning's book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. And Paul Manning, of course, was the top CBS journalist for the US throughout World War II, so he was very well connected. If people want to research these things, no doubt they can go to our webpage and find the relevant links to follow up the stories.
That's right. Well, I'll put some links up on the webpage, which is thisweek.org.uk, and you can find the Paul Manning book for free as a PDF on the Spitfire List, Dave Emery's website. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7. Our sister show Dialect, I'm afraid, isn't on anymore. I'll be bringing you news about that in the future. Thanks to our guests in the first hour, Labour Councillor for South Mead, Jenny Smith. Thanks also to Kevin Carhill and Teo Aluko, and to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. You can find us online at thisweek.org.uk, and I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us on the politics show at 5 o'clock next week, and don't let those banksters get you down. Winning community radio station for